Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, March 16th. This is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times and CapeCodTimes.com is Patrick Cassidy. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning, Steve.
And joining us later will be Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette. We'll hear from Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll speak with Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner, George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, and we'll check in with Andy Tomolonis at SouthCoastToday.com. Patrick, it's almost hard to remember that this week started with a lovely morning on Monday. The day started to change as it went along, and by Tuesday, a blizzard was knocking out power for many across the region. And for quite some while, that power outage map was densely maroon and purple, not the colors that you want to see at all.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a nice day out today, which is, again, hard to believe, as you pointed out before we came on the air. Started nice, ended nice. But in between was another one of these nor'easters, and it knocked power out, as these often do, to lots of Cape Codders. It was, I think, we were looking the day of the storm, blizzard, and it was officially a blizzard, according to the National Weather Service, on Tuesday. And at the height of what we saw as far as power outages, it was more than 125,000 people on Cape Cod without power. Eversource, which is the utility, says that across their whole territory, they've since that day or since the storm restored power to 460,000 people in total. And I'm not sure if that counts people who had their power restored and then it went back off, as sometimes happens, and gets restored again. But a lot of people without power, a lot of people without power for, you know, maybe the third or second or third time this month, and certainly the second or third time in the last or in the last 2 months since the January 4th storm, with all that flooding that came with that. There were some winds then. With this storm in particular, and with the storm on March 2nd, there were a lot of high winds, I think more than 80 miles per hour with this storm. I think the March 2nd storm had more than 90 miles per hour in some cases. And again, there were a lot of these outages. A lot of people, their homes didn't have power, didn't have heat. They were looking for some place to go, and the regional shelter system, which is operated by the, and that's a mouthful, the Barnesville County Regional Emergency Planning Committee, they decided to open 3 out of the 6 regional shelters, one in Hyannis, one in Sandwich, and one in Harwich. And the one in Harwich at Cape Tech ended up being the one with the most people. I think a little over 100 people were there at one point, a few animals. All of these shelters are now equipped to accept pets, because they realized early on that people were didn't want to leave their pets at home.
Stay away from the shelter if they couldn't bring their pets.
So they had those shelters open Tuesday night. They decided a little later in the day to open their shelters Tuesday night starting at 7. And then again Wednesday night. Schools on Wednesday across the Cape, for the most part, were canceled. I think Provincetown maybe had a generator up there, so they were able to hold school. But schools were canceled. I mean, I think it's two things. A, you know, you're worried about people getting there and back on a day where there's a bunch of snow on the ground. And also, some of these schools were acting as shelters, so they were places where they didn't want to have a shelter in place, and also classes. But again, a lot of people sought shelter at these locations, but also went there to power up, because these days you've got all your equipment and cell phones and iPads, and you're looking for just a place with power that you can plug into. A lot of people, I think, were sitting in their cars powering up at different times to keep in touch. That was another problem, though. AT&T and I think Sprint both had issues on the Cape with their service.
Big problem for many people. Yeah. And you think that people without power, sitting without any communication, is a recipe for some real safety issues that people were concerned about.
And especially when these days landlines are not as common as they used to be. You know, back in the day, you could pick up your landline even without power and still be able to call through. But these days, a lot of people, I think I haven't had a landline for like 20 years now, but a lot of people are without landlines, and they rely on their cell phone for emergencies. And if you don't have service, then you're going to run into those problems. I don't think Verizon had as much of a problem or had any real problems from the sounds of it, but AT&T in particular did not have service over a large part of the Cape. And this came up during a meeting where the governor came to the Cape. And this was I get the days confused. 2 days ago, I think, at this point. But
on Wednesday.
Wednesday, the governor came down and he went to the Multi-Agency Coordination Center, which is at the Barnesville County Complex, and it's kind of this hub where...
Like the command center, right? For emergency response across the county, Barnesville County.
Exactly, and they've had this for a number of years now where they bring everybody together in a room. They can monitor power outages. I think they have a screen they throw up all this information on about outages, about road closures. There were a lot of road closures. A lot of trees came down again during this storm.
More than 200 reported trees coming down. I know the Falmouth Police was reporting big numbers of trees that they were responding to coming down across roads and on wires.
Yeah, and Falmouth was one of the harder hit in terms of high winds. I think at one point they were reporting more than 100 trees and poles down early on. I think it did jump to even beyond that. Barnstable also was reporting the same sort of thing. And again, this coordination center where the governor was, you know, it was a photo op. You know, he was there. He was able to hear from local lawmakers, and some of them gave him, you know, an earful, as our headline said, because they were upset about the information coming out of Eversource. Every time one of these storms happens, there's concerns about whether people are getting the right information quickly enough. These towns, Provincetown in particular, I think state representative up there, Sarah Peake, said that they were told at one point that they were 23% without power based on the outage map from Eversource. And a lot of this has improved over the years because of complaints that have taken place. But they turned around and said, no, we're not 23% without power. We're completely without power. We have no power. And so then Eversource came back and said, well, okay, we're going to get your power back on, but it may be two days or a day or two before it happens. And then people's power started coming back on more quickly, which was also a problem because the town had started to take steps to address that, like look at whether they need to open a shelter, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So, again, a lot of concerns and complaints about the lack of cell service during the storm, about the power outages and the information coming through Eversource. But you got to imagine, this was 125,000 or more people without power. It's a lot to deal with, and certainly it's not something where you can go flip a switch. You got to go find all the different areas, and even when you get chunks down, and now we're down to, I haven't checked recently, but it was a couple thousand last night of people still without power. But even when you get those big chunks, 20,000, 40,000 people back on, you're going to get down into the neighborhood by neighborhood, street by street, and house by house fight in terms of figuring out where
that house,
smaller problems
that
are.
That house at the end of the road that has power lines coming, that have come down on the way to that house, and that's a big job just to put one or two houses together sometimes, that last mile there.
Or people who don't realize that the problem is actually on their side of the meter, and that's the point where the utility says, that's not us, you got to go hire an electrician because something has happened within your house, and that's your problem. It's not the power getting to your house. It's now on your side of the meter.
You know, when the power's out, it's easy to feel like this calamity is going on way too long. But in some sense, it's amazing to think that we're sitting here right now, Friday morning, and power has basically substantially been restored to the region. And those outage numbers were tremendous. And what a manpower effort that was on behalf of the utility companies to put that back together, and a lot of them working in very tough conditions.
Yeah, and the Secretary of Energy and Environmental Affairs for the state said exactly that. He said it was a lot to put back on. Again, there's always going to be concerns and complaints, and certainly people have to be concerned about people who may be a little older or maybe in vulnerable situations who are in a home without power and heat. The faster, the better. But you're right. It is pretty amazing that a couple days in, we're kind of back up and running.
Sarah Brown is with us from the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
Sarah, how did the Vineyard make out where you were?
We didn't get so much snow as some places, certainly the blowing snow of a blizzard, really. But we definitely had the wind, and we officially had blizzard conditions, which meant the gusting winds and the snow. The main story, like so many other places and like you were just talking about, is with power outages. Large parts of the island were without power on Tuesday and into Wednesday, mainly Up Island and Aquinnah and Chilmark, all of Aquinnah, which is a small town, but all of the town was without power for quite a while, I think into yesterday morning, and most of Chilmark and West Chisbury were also without power, and pockets of outages in other towns too, and crews have been working here around the clock. They came over on the ferry before the storm, so there are some people here, more came afterward. As of this morning, I think about 100, just about 100 households were still without power, which I'm sure isn't fun for those people. But I think at the peak of the storm, about 7,000 households were without power. So certainly a big effort has been made to return power to people on the island who are without.
Sarah, I want to ask you about another story. Last summer, Martha's Vineyard Hospital fired its CEO, and without offering much in the way of explanation, now it appears some information's come to light on this. What have you learned?
Yeah, so as you said, there's Martha's Vineyard CEO, hospital CEO, Joseph Wooden, was fired last June pretty abruptly after 13 months on the job, and this really created a stir on the island. You know, because of how sudden it was, and a lot of people said he was well-liked and were clamoring for more transparency and explanation from the hospital board of trustees about why Mr. Wooden was fired. And we have a story this week that does offer a closer look at what happened. And this is thanks to dozens of pages of documents that were filed in Dukes County Superior Court, I think last week or early March. As part of a legal proceeding, the hospital was trying to guarantee repayment of a loan they made to Mr. Wooden that they're saying he should be paying back. And through those documents that were filed in relation to this, there's really a good look at what happened at the hospital leading up to Mr. Wooden's firing, and then also the severance discussions that have been going on since then. Mr. Wooden and his lawyers say that, you know, he had raised concerns about the job performance of the wife of the chairman of the hospital's board of trustees who works at the hospital, and he had started to take steps to try to address those concerns, and he claims his firing was made to protect her. The hospital disputes this and raised a host of issues they said they had with Mr. Wooden's management, and efforts he was making to kind of undermine the relationship between the hospital and Partners Healthcare, which owns the hospital. So there's these two different stories laid out through arbitration documents and also an ongoing, and so they are an arbitration. There's also an ongoing discussion and lots of emails back and forth between lawyers about a severance agreement. It looks like they almost came to an agreement, and then it was discovered, the hospital said they discovered they had been paying Mr. Wooden since he was terminated for several months, and that he needed to repay that money, and that became a sticking point that torpedoed the settlement agreement. So that court proceeding ended up giving a little look at, you know, certainly two different accounts and of what happened, and also the ongoing discussions between the two parties that that a lot of people have been wondering about for almost a year now.
Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette, thanks for updating us on that story.
Thank you. Have a good weekend.
You are listening to the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. We're going to go to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We are discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. On the line right now is Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, I'm guessing power outage is the big issue where you are with the storm, or they were the big issue where you are with the storm this week.
Yeah, definitely. They certainly were. This area lost power on Tuesday, came back a little bit Wednesday, and then was off for most of the day. At one point, and came back Wednesday night, 100% of Chatham was without power. I think we were one of the few towns that completely lost power here. And of course, that was due to a lot of down trees, down wires here and elsewhere. We didn't get much snow, only maybe 5 or 6 inches here, and it was all very wet and slushy. And of course, that contributed to the wires that came down. And you know, crews were still out yesterday around town, continuing to make those repairs.
Tim, you have an interesting story this week about the town of Chatham doing what you call some radical landscaping to create more space in its cemeteries.
Yeah, it seems that you know, Chatham's a popular place to visit, and a lot of people want to spend eternity here, apparently. So the town has 4 active cemeteries, and the 2 biggest are basically running out of space. And after an extensive planning process, the town is now expanding those 2 cemeteries in a rather unique way, as you mentioned. The Union Cemetery backs up to a large hill that has been just sort of a scrub-covered hill for many years. And in the last few weeks, the town has there's been heavy equipment in there, basically leveling the hill so that it could be used for cemetery plots. Now, what they've done is they've taken the earth that they've sort of topped off that hill, and they've brought it over to Seaside Cemetery, which is about a quarter of a mile away, and they've used it to fill in some town-owned land adjacent to that cemetery that will be used to expand that cemetery. They've also used a lot of that dirt, oddly enough, to put on beaches and town landings over the last few few weeks because of the storms. And apparently, it's very good quality material and suitable for putting on the beaches. So it's helped hold some of those town landings and beaches against erosion during the storms. Now, the cemetery project is expected to be completed in the next few weeks, and once they get the sort of landscaping done, grass planted, and a few roads put in, town officials say there'll be about 2,000 new grave sites created. The whole project cost about $650,000 from start to finish. Now, as an interesting aside, Steve, the hill that they've just sort of removed back in the between about 1952 and 60, atop it sat a U.S. Air Force radar facility, and it was part of the East Coast early warning radar system, and warning against potential enemy incursion. And that was decommissioned in the early 60s, and for many years it was kind of this mysterious place where, because it had been classified, the use, so nobody really knew what went on there for many years. For a long time, it was just this sort of ramshackle old building until the building came down and the town took over the property, and now it's going to be a cemetery.
Tim.
A bit of a strange evolution.
Yes. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
Patrick Cassidy from the Cape Cod Times. Patrick, even before the blizzard on Tuesday, we had seen a couple of nor'easters come through in 2 weeks, and these were storms that did some substantial damage to Nickerson Park.
Yeah, and obviously we've been talking about trees coming down. Nickerson State Park has had this happen in the past with previous storms where a lot of trees had come down. Over the course of January and through March, I believe, these nor'easters took about 200 trees down within the park.
200 trees.
It's a lot. I mean, there are a lot of trees in Nickerson, having been there, but at the same time, these were some pretty substantial trees. No major damage from this most recent storm. I think a bike rack got dinged up from the March 2nd storm is what this was actually referring to. The damage from the recent storm, I think they're probably still assessing, but they are going through and assessing. And the biggest thing, obviously, with Nickerson, there are some people who certainly plenty of people who use the park during the winter, but they're looking forward to obviously the spring and the summer crowds, and that's when it really gets jammed in there. And you want those bike paths, and you want those walkways free and easy so people and tourists and visitors and locals alike can get through there. So that's what they're dealing with now, is kind of assessing how they deal with getting those out of there. They don't really have a budget for emergency response to storm damage, but they still hope to have everything cleared out by Memorial Day weekend, which is obviously the first big weekend of summer.
And I have to point out that your reporter, Doug Frazier, in this article has a great descriptive line in which he says that enormous branches that had been carved off the trees like breast meat on a turkey by the wind.
Doug does like to wax poetic sometimes. It's fun to read.
Looking at the next story, town meeting voters in three Cape towns this spring are going to be asked to approve a partnership to address their wastewater issues.
Yeah, this is Dennis, Harwich, and Yarmouth. And this really speaks to this larger issue of towns working across borders and with a watershed concept in mind in terms of how you deal with these wastewater problems. The county, the Cape Cod Commission, has put together a kind of regional plan in a general sense that calls for these types of partnerships. But Dennis, Harwich, and Yarmouth are looking at ways to do this. They got a $100,000 state grant to explore costs and ways of implementing a regional agreement between the two towns. Interestingly, there are already agreements between a couple of these towns. On the one side, I think Yarmouth and Dennis, I think, are looking at an agreement on, you know, Yarmouth is also looking to Barnstable and a potential agreement with them. But this work that they're doing here would establish what's called the DHY, Clean Waters Community Partnership. It's not, you know, a board that has any necessary power except to work together on this draft regional treatment plan. The idea would be to have the wastewater come to Dennis and be treated there and returned to the groundwater there. And again, Dennis is kind of the central location here between Yarmouth and Harwich, so that's why that works. But it still does have to go to town meeting to even create that partnership. Then once the draft regional plan is put in place, it has to go back to the three boards of selectmen, and then it has to go back to a second town meeting before the plan can be implemented. So there's a lot of work still here to be done, but again, it's also something that's going on across the Cape where towns are looking across their borders and looking at kind of a watershed basis for how they treat this, and it's not just one town. Obviously, everybody always says the water flows across borders, So that's what they're dealing with.
And there's some sense of urgency as the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection is really leaning on towns to take on the wastewater issue in a big way.
Yeah, interestingly, Kristen Young, who was the reporter on this, had a letter that was sent by the Mass DEP in response to an inquiry from the Yarmouth Town Administrator. And he basically said, you know, the DEP sees this as the most effective and affordable approach to solving the Cape's water quality problems. That's the regional watershed-based management approach that he's talking about, and essentially says, if you don't do it, we could come in and have individual homeowners have to upgrade their septic systems, which it would be an extremely costly initiative for each individual homeowners. And even if we did that, we still may have to come in and have you do something that's a little larger and more system-wide. So the towns are looking at this and saying, let's just get ahead of this at this point and do it ourselves.
So town meeting voters in these three towns have to approve this at their May town meeting, it sounds like.
Yep, and again, that's just the first step to get this partnership going, and then they'll go from there.
One of the other consequences of the storm this week was that many schools were closed across the region, and this included on Wednesday, a day when many student protests had been scheduled.
Yes, across the country, this was the day that a lot of students were walking out of their schools in a fairly organized protest or way to raise awareness for the need for school safety. This is obvious for anybody who's watching the news in the last month in response to the Parkland, Florida shooting in which 17 students and faculty members down in that school in Florida were killed by a shooter. And so schools on the Cape were going to be taking part on Wednesday. Again, as we said earlier, almost every school on the Cape had classes canceled on Wednesday. They still did, some of the students still did take part in some standouts that were put together by an adult group of protesters who were part of the Indivisible Movement, and they occurred mostly on the lower outer Cape, where they had about six of these standouts, and students showed up for that. But we've been kind of checking in with schools about whether things and schools and student organizers about whether any of these are being rescheduled. Several of them were supposed to be rescheduled for today. I think Nauset is moving forward with theirs, Nauset Regional High School, and Monomoy Regional High School is moving forward with theirs. It's kind of been interesting for us because to get information on this, we're talking to student organizers. We're trying to talk to administrators, not always successfully. Obviously, they're dealing with the storm and they're dealing with a lot of things, but getting information about whether these are happening. And one of the other interesting things that's happened is, you know, some of these have been closed to press or closed to the public, which I guess the question is whether that defeats the purpose in terms of getting your voice heard and getting people to raise awareness about this issue. So again, they're moving forward in a couple of towns. Some of the town or some of the schools have kind of put them off indefinitely, and some of the student organizers are saying they're now focused on March 24th, which is this event that's again going to be nationwide, Washington D.C., I think, Boston, and also Hyannis Village Green, where students are going to come out and march basically as a form of protest, looking for gun control laws to be more strict, and looking for other ways to increase safety in schools after this shooting in Florida.
And what we heard from schools is that they were closed to the press or closed to the public in because of safety issues. They have kids that are coming out of the school and are standing out front, and they're trying to...
So the question arises, are they concerned that the media members of the media, and again, general public, I guess I could understand that. Are they concerned that members of the media are a danger to the students? That, again, it's a question that I've been asking, and you know, I haven't heard a good response as to why you would possibly move forward with what's supposed to be a visual demonstration of something and then close it off to the media and close it off to an avenue by which people can see that. It flies in the face of logic as far as I'm concerned.
We will see more on this issue, as you say, in the next couple of weeks as this walkout on the 20 or this protest on the 24th comes together. We want to speak now with Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Steve, and Patrick, too.
Good morning, Ed.
Ed, in Provincetown Harbor, a derelict fishing boat proved itself to be more than just an eyesore this past week during the storm.
That's right. This is kind of a classic fishing town story. There's a 42-foot dragger, the Artemis, a rusty old boat that arrived in Provincetown Harbor last July and has been a subject of speculation ever since. The boat, which belongs to John Christensen of Yarmouth, has not been actively used since last summer. It was stripped of all gear and fuel. It had been towed into the harbor after it blew its transmission while fishing in Gloucester. And this was done without the permission or knowledge of the Provincetown Harbor Master, Rex McKenzie, who was rather agitated about that fact. Well, what happened just 2 weeks ago, as the nor'easter of that weekend came through, the one that the weather people called Riley.
We have to keep them straight, yes.
Right. At about 9 a.m. on Friday, March the 2nd, Artemis broke loose from its mooring near McMillan Pier in Provincetown and was blown westward by the hurricane force winds until it got pushed up against the rocks of the breakwater in the west end. A very dramatic sight. I actually went out that morning to go around town and see what was happening as far as the flooding was concerned at around high tide, and found out there at the west end a whole crowd of people watching this boat dramatically smashing up against the rocks. Well, the boat is still there 2 weeks later, and Rex McKenzie, the harbor master, told us that he'd been trying to get the owner to get it towed away, but with no success. It also emerged this week that Christensen had previously tried to moor the boat in Chatham, but was denied permission by the Chatham Harbor Master, Stuart Smith. Smith told Katie Ward, our reporter, quote, "He contacted me and said, 'I'm going to bring it to Chatham.' And I said, 'No, you're not.'" Smith added that he knew Christensen and was familiar with the boat. "I knew it was going to die its own death," he said, "and I didn't want it in my harbor." So Christensen went ahead and got somebody to tow it into Provincetown. It got moored by the pier, moved over to another mooring owned by Barry Clifford, who did it just sort of as a good neighbor, he said. Now it's not entirely clear what's going to happen to the boat. The town did not want to get involved in seizing it because of the possibility of liability in case the boat should just sink. As of Tuesday, when we talked to McKenzie last, he said that the last he heard, they were going to try and fill the boat with foam, patch the holes so they could get it refloated, and then eventually repair it. But we'll have to follow that story and see whether that happens or not.
Ed, I want to ask you briefly about the storm in Provincetown. You were one of the towns that had 100% outages reported, and Representative Sarah Peek was very vocal, expressing her frustration with the state of the grid going down a couple of times in the last month and people having to not only pay expensive electricity costs, but pay for generators as well. What was the storm and the outages like for you on the ground there?
Well, it was very trying here. Of course, as the storm blew through on Tuesday, a lot of people lost power. But by Tuesday night, it seemed as if things were getting better and power was getting restored. And then at around 11 a.m. on Wednesday, all of Provincetown, all of Truro, and most of Wellfleet lost power again. And it was out for most of the day. And what the Eversource representative, Priscilla Rest, told us was that they had to restore a main transmission line, and that in order to fix that line, they had to just shut all the power down. Now, you know, why that had to happen right after a major storm, we don't know. But she did tell us that there's been an enormous amount of damage to the electrical system over these past couple of months with the repeated storms, and so they've obviously been working very hard to get power restored. Last I checked, there were still about 50 customers in Wellfleet without power this morning, and a few more in Truro, and apparently just two in Provincetown. But Wellfleet has been hard hit, and we actually have a story in this week's banner about the situation in Wellfleet and why it's been subject to so many power outages. And there was a meeting with Eversource representatives by the Wellfleet selectmen trying to get them to make some changes here.
Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner. Ed, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome, Steve.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times, Patrick Cassidy. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. There's more in a moment. Welcome back to the News Roundup on the Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. On the line with us right now from the Martha's Vineyard Times is George Brennan. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Steve. How are you today?
Doing really well, George. I'm so happy to see sunshine back again.
It is nice.
George, from where you were, how did the island fare?
Yeah, so a lot of trees down, obviously, and power outages everywhere. You know, the story right now is cleanup is still going on days after this storm. Most of the power has been restored. A couple of communities were completely without power for the better part of 2 days or more. And, you know, we have an interesting story from Rich Salzberg that from yesterday of a cleanup in West Tisbury. Interesting video with it, so I encourage people to go and check that out. They actually used a plow. The street was flooded with water, and there were logs and trees in the road, so they just used a plow to push it all out of the way. Pretty interesting concept of use of a snow plow there. And also, Barry Stringfellow was at a meeting of the Martha's Vineyard Commission last night, where they gave approval to do some work on the East Chop Bluff, which had been decimated in these recent storms, you know, this series of storms, already a fragile area, but these punishing storms have really created some more significant damage there. So they're giving permission to proceed with some work on that to shore that up. So a lot in the aftermath, and oh, by the way, maybe another one coming. Mm. Right?
I want to talk about a story you had in the Times earlier in the program. Here, we were just speaking with Ed Miller about a derelict boat coming loose in Provincetown Harbor. You have a story about with a different kind of emotional wallop. It's about a boat that came loose, but was definitely not derelict, and has sounds like it's done for now. Tell us a little bit about this.
Yeah, yeah. So this was a couple, Jeannie Sternback and Pascal Abeniz. They had purchased the Witch of Endor, and it was moored in Vineyard Haven Harbor. This is a boat that they used for charters, and you know, there have been weddings on it, and just has a great story to it. And this couple purchased it. This was their dream to have a sailboat that they could use for charters and really make their business out of. And, you know, this is not the story of a couple with deep pockets that, you know, went out and purchased a boat for their pleasure. This is, a couple that wanted to make this a livelihood. And it came loose during that first nor'easter, that really powerful one where so many boats did come loose. And this is the one that got caught up next to the slip of the Steamship Authority in Vineyard Haven Harbor, and really had become sort of a tourist attraction, people getting on and off the ferry, taking pictures of it because you just don't see that. We had a tremendous story about it being pulled off the pier last week, and unfortunately, it suffered so much damage that this couple just can't afford to do the repairs. So they're going to sell that boat and get what they can for it, and then try to rewrite their dream. They'll have to save up and figure out how to purchase another boat down the road to be able to move forward and offer cruises and weddings aboard a boat and the types of things that they want to do. It's sort of a heart-wrenching story, and they offered quite a few details about what this has been like for them, their journey. And sadly, they didn't have insurance on the boat at the time. And, that's just people can read it for themselves, but that's a heartbreaking part of this whole thing as well.
It's a very nicely put together story, and also touches on the community effort in helping them to sort of come through all of this. George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve. Take care.
Patrick Cassidy from the Cape Cod Times. Patrick, Barnstable County has been struggling financially and taking a hard look at its finances. And then this week comes a story about Assembly of Delegates members upgrading hotel rooms at the expense of the county.
Yeah, and basically officials in towns and counties across the state attend these conferences. This is the Massachusetts Municipal Association meeting and trade show that took place a little ways back. It was at the Sheraton Boston Hotel. And there's a, as with a lot of these things, there's a group rate for rooms. In this case, it was $174 for a single and $184 for a double room. But the rooms for about a half a dozen members of the Assembly of Delegates at the Barnstable County Assembly of Delegates, which is the legislative body for the county government here, our regional government, which provides a variety of services. They operate a $29 million budget. There's the executive branch and the legislative branch, which is the assembly here, 15 members, one from each town. Some of these members had their rooms upgraded. It's not exactly clear, and in one case, one of the assembly delegates who we spoke to, reporter Jeff Spillane spoke to, said he had no idea that the upgrade cost money at the time until he left the hotel and saw the bill.
So they were upgraded to suites costing as much as more than $300 a night.
$300 a night. And in total, this was about $2,000. And again, when you look at that in a lot of contexts, it seems like small money, but you're talking about a small government here in this county government. And there's been a lot of questions over the years about county government, how it's run, its functions, whether there's overlap or too much overlap with what towns
are doing. Yes.
So in any case, this became an issue, and it turns out that the assembly's clerk Janice O'Connell had upgraded these rooms, and she had said, when again contacted by our reporter, that it had been upgraded because it was a secure floor that they were on. Jeff reached out to the hotel and asked them about that. They said, "Well, we don't really have secure floors. We have this club lounge where you need a special key to get up to that, but that's not even a secure floor, and that's not where we're necessarily talking about here." So again, on the other side of this, the county commissioners and the chairman of the county commissioners said he would want an immediate review and thorough review of the county's reimbursement policies, basically how these funds are expended. The Speaker of the Assembly, who's the head of that group, said that while she appreciates the concern for the money here and for the expense of the money, the Assembly still didn't exceed this $17,500 in-state travel budget, so they weren't outside of their budget. This also, you know, is part of a look that the commissioners in particular, I think, are taking at the Assembly of Delegates clerk position, and that's a $86,000 a year position, and whether it's really a full-time position, they say, well, we want to take some of her hours and bring them over to the county commissioners because she's really a county employee and belongs kind of under our auspices in some ways. The speaker again said, I'm not interested in that. She's basically our employee, and we want to keep her full time at the assembly. So it raises a lot of issues. There's for years and years and years, there's been this kind of war or low level war between the Assembly of Delegates, the legislative branch, and the executive branch. It happens in a lot of governments, obviously. But in this case, this expense of money that a lot of people didn't think was appropriate kind of raised the stakes a little bit and has brought this to the fore.
Andy Tomolonis is joining us now from SouthCoastToday.com and New Bedford Standard Times. Good morning, Andy.
Hello, Steve.
Andy, we've been talking storm stories here, and I know that you have a story looking at the costs of snow removal across the South Coast area.
Yes, that's right. And the good news is we're well into March, and despite the storm pattern, it is almost spring. The sun is stronger this time of year, and the snow is melting. But it's melting slowly, and there's a lot of costs still associated with the cleanup. So New Bedford's chief financial officer, Ari Skye, told us this week that the latest storm alone is likely to cost the city between $100,000 and $200,000, $100,000 and $200,000. So before the storm, the city had a budget just under $35,000 left in its snow account, and so the storm easily wiped that out. So what happens to happen next is they just run into a deficit and they find money to transfer from somewhere else. But it's just a very costly storm. So, barring future storms this winter, the snow budget, won't be that far out of whack. It was $450,000. So there isn't a snow insurance policy if they hit like 55 inches or something, but it doesn't look like even if we get more snow next week, and they're talking about that storm possibly end of the week, it doesn't look like we're going to get hit with any number that would allow the insurance to kick in. In our area, Acushnet got the jackpot about 18 inches, and
18,
New Bedford and Dartmouth had about 14 inches of snow. So other than that, there was the usual power outages. We've had all three storms. This was all snow, mostly snow in New Bedford, and the other ones were rain here. But we did have a lot of power outages and trees down, and most of them are restored now. When you look at the Eversource map, which we go to quite frequently, and in most of our communities, it's under 100, but it's really down lower than that. It's mostly in the single digits of people who still have are without power.
Andy, I want to ask you briefly about an update on a story you have for us on Michelle Carter, the young woman who was found guilty of inciting her boyfriend to commit suicide, and she did it through text messages.
Yes, this is a very unusual case. She was a young woman. Conrad Roy III was 18, and Michelle Carter was 17, and they carried on these multiple texting conversations. The teenager, Conrad Roy, from Mattapoisett, used a gas-powered pump inside the cab of his pickup truck to commit suicide via carbon monoxide poisoning. He was having second thoughts about it, and she told him to get back into the vehicle. And there was a trial, and she was convicted of involuntary manslaughter last year. So this week, the state Supreme Judicial Court agreed to hear a direct appeal of her conviction. The defense had asked to bypass the regular route, which is the state appeals court, and go directly to the SJC because there's constitutional issues involved with this one. So far, there's no date set for the court case. So she's right now she was sentenced to 2.5 years in the Bristol County House of Correction, 15 months to serve and 15 months suspended. But her stay of execution of her sentence while the appeal was pending for state courts. And her defense team cites a bunch of reasons for the direct appellate review, and among them, the trial judge improperly convicted Carter of a type of involuntary manslaughter which the grand jury did not indict her for, and that was a failure to act. Mm-hmm. So there's a few other reasons, but it'll be interesting to see where this case goes.
Andy Tomalonis, SouthCoastToday.com. Andy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
Patrick Cassidy from the Cape Cod Times. A positive story out of Chatham from your reporter Cindy McCormick about the Monomoy Regional High School boosting its graduation rate.
And just for the record, Harwich, as a Harwichian, I want to make it clear that the high school is in Harwich, but that's...
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's
you are right.
The district is Chatham and Harwich together, obviously.
Yeah, but the high school is in Harwich.
Yep. And so the school is new. It was a new school as of a few years ago, and when they did build it, it wasn't immediately good results in terms of graduation rates. They had a 76.9% graduation rate in that first year, the class of 2015, and that's well below the state's four-year graduation rate of 87.3%. And so the school took a hard look. I think our reporter Cindy McCormick had done some reporting at the time, and the school really did some soul searching and did a hard look at what they were doing. And they took a number of steps. They developed a task force. They hired a coordinator of a new academic center that gives high schools credit for tutoring peers who need help. They started a summer school, invested in online classes. They loosened up the requirements for students to get into AP courses, developed a uniform homework policy. And one of the more interesting things is they decided that the lunch, way they did lunch, which was this staggered kind of typical of a lot of schools, the way they did lunch wasn't really working. So they did what they called JAWSOME, I think, which is a just giant lunch hour for everybody, essentially. And it sounds like you can kind of just take lunch wherever you want to do it. You can be in the cafeteria, you can be in a classroom working on things. It's an opportunity for students to do more one-on-one work with teachers and to hang out with friends that they might not otherwise get to hang out with because they're staggered schedules. And they said a lot of this worked. And what happened was they climbed to a 90.2% graduation rate for the class of 2017. And that's an increase of 13 points, which is fairly dramatic, and it's above the state average now. So they look at this and they say, this really worked. Cindy talked to our reporter, Cindy McCormick, talked to a number of students who said they thought it was working. Teachers, administrators said they all thought it was working. And they've even turned around. They had some school choice exodus that was occurring right after they had built the new school, and they've even turned around, and it looks like they're getting students to come to the school now. So for Monomoy, it sounds like a good news story, but it took a lot of changes on their part, and I think it took some soul-searching as to what they could do better.
Again and again, throughout the article, the administrator is talking about changing the culture at the school in order to make this happen.
And again, that's a buzzword, but at the same time, in this case, it looks like they really did it. Yeah.
You can see, or the story relates how they really got their hands in there and worked to change it. I want to talk quickly about, each town across the region struggling to find its way on regulating sales of marijuana. In Brewster, a special town meeting took place to look at this. Where did they come down on this?
Yeah, and Brewster's interesting because they had, I think, as a town, voted against recreational marijuana, and then they decided to move forward with allowing recreational marijuana facilities within the town. This was a series of four articles. It was a special town meeting. They essentially approved all of the articles, and they have to do with zoning for recreational marijuana facilities. They're basically going to allow one because it's 20% of the liquor stores in town is essentially how it reads. It can be up to the number of 20% of the liquor stores in town, and that equates to one. A medical marijuana facility can transfer into a recreational facility. And then they did a bunch of other things that would allow recreational marijuana to take place, including collecting a 3% local sales tax, which is the most they can get.
And they're going to have them only in standalone buildings.
Absolutely. You can read more at CapeCodTimes.com.
You certainly can. I want to thank my guest, Patrick Cassidy from the Cape Cod Times. Thank you, Patrick, for being here this morning.
Thanks, Steve.
And I want to thank my other contributors. We heard from Sarah Brown, the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood, the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Balling, the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner, George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, and thanks to Andy Tomalonis at SouthCoastToday.com. Thank you for listening. I'm Steve Junker.